Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome again to the Edinburgh International Book Festival. It's my treat to introduce you to Danny Dorling, who is the author of this book, Inequality and the 1%. Before we start, may I thank the Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust for their sponsorship of this and other events. The sponsors are really important to the festival, so we're very grateful indeed. Danny grew up in Oxford, went to the University of Newcastle, is now back in Oxford as Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. The reason I was interested in this, my name's Alan Little, by the way, I'm a broadcaster and journalist, but some of you are repeat offenders of this festival, so probably know that already. Inequality in the 1%. Danny and I were just talking before we came in, and I was saying to him that I'm about a decade older than him. I was born at the very end of the 1950s, 1959. And children born in my year were peak social mobility kids. So after the Second World War, social mobility rose and rose, and then in the beginning of the 1960s, the children born in 1960, it fell again. And the story that, of this country, or one of the stories of this country in the course of my adult lifetime, from the early 1980s through to now, is a retreat from the values of the second of the post-war settlement, a retreat from the idea of greater and greater social mobility and increasing social equality, and that's what we're here to talk about. Danny's going to give us a short presentation shortly, but Danny, let me ask you that first question. Why has that happened? Why is it the kids born after me are less likely to advance through a certain social bracket?
Okay, you're born in 59, so your cohort of boys would have been, I can't get my maths wrong now,
mid-70s.
It's mid-70s, 1974, age 15, for the majority of the baby entered the labour market then, because school leaving age was 15 for most kids.
60.
Oh, it's really
good. 60. Even people as ancient as me had to say
school. Oh, no, maybe Scotland is Scotland.
Of course, we are better educated.
Back then in England, you could sleep in England at Easter before taking your exams. Was anybody age people on this?
Yes, I was born 56.
And you had to wait for
16.
Oh, maybe that's what your parents have told you. Anyway. We're talking 1973, 74, it's much of a budget, as you know. In that year, the best of 1% were taking 6% of all income. After tax, which was a third of their income, they were taking 4%. That's four times the average person's wage. So a well-paid banker in London would be getting £100,000. Not a million or 2 million, but £100,000. The 1% back then consisted of people from many different walks of life. Head teachers were in 1%, doctors were in 1%, GPs now, apart from 200 GPs, also sell drugs. GPs, dispensing.
I'm sure there are some in this audience.
Actually, I do wonder how many now. The 1% was spread out. You're always going to have 1%, of course, and always going to be exactly 1% of the population. But they were spread out socially, they were spread out across the country, they were found everywhere. Since the mid-1970s, and accelerated after 79, the 1% have moved away, along the rest of the 10%, and they've become geographically more concentrated in particular parts of particular countries. So in Scotland, they're concentrated, up in Aberdeen and in Edinburgh. But in the UK as a whole, they're concentrated in London and the South East in particular. And in 1979, the group just beneath them, the rest of the 10%, got 2.5 times average income. By the time Margaret Thatcher left office in 1990, the rest of the 10% got 3 times average income. So they went up as well, but of course the 1% went up much, much more. They could do that because they were rewarding the people just below them. Since the crash, the rest of the 10% have actually seen their incomes drop, and the 1% is carrying on going up. So the reason to talk about the 1% is we've got a new cleavage in Britain. It is between 99% and 1%, and the reason for the cleavage is because it's literally whose income has gone down and whose income is going up, and the squeeze middle is all about the top 10%.
Right. Well, we'll talk shortly about why you think that matters, and why you believe it's harmful for some people to be fabulously rich, while other people still think, and can argue very well, that it's good for all of us that some people are fabulously wealthy, because they are that is the sector that creates the investment that generates jobs for others. So we'll have that argument after you've given your presentation. But ladies and gentlemen, please give a very warm Edinburgh welcome to Daniel.
Okay, let's try not to give you too many numbers on this. But it's got a percentage in the title, so it is a statistical book. It's what it says on the tin. It's inequality and the 1%. So half of it's about inequality and half of it's about 1%. And I've just told you why the 1% has become, as far as I'm concerned, very important as a group. But it's also about the connection between inequality and the 1%. We've got quite good data on the 1% going back a century from tax records, and we have that data for a series of countries so that we know that our 1% took far less when you were a young man. We know they took far more when your parents were born. If you go back to the, I'm not going to ask you when they were born, but if we go back to 1920s, 1930s, the 1% were taking at the beginning of that period about 20% of all income. They're currently taking about 15, a seventh of all our income goes to just 1% of the population. The only other rich countries in the world where this occurs are places like the United States and Singapore. In the Netherlands, the 1% just taking just over 6%. So there's an incredible variation in what's happening. This hasn't happened everywhere. I should let you know whether you're in the 1%. I forgot to do that. And we'll ask you to put your hands up in a minute.
This is Edinburgh, nobody's going to do that.
They won't do that. Yeah. And there's another great difference for being in Edinburgh. In my favourite question in book festivals in England is to ask people to put up their hands if they're shy Tories. But we know there are no shy Tories in Edinburgh. A few. Yeah, maybe shy Labour. Okay, if you are bringing in £160,000 a year and you're living on your own, congratulations, you've just made it into the 1%. If you're a couple, you need to be earning about £200,000. We can also do it by wealth, and as you are an older than average audience, the wealth thing might be better. If you have a spare million, you're in the 1%. What a spare million means is not the value of the property you're living in, because you have to live in that, and not the value of your pension. It's the value of your other properties, all those buy-to-let flats that you've bought. Okay? If everything that you could sell off quick and still live comes to a million, you're in the 1% by dint of your wealth. So that's the group you're on about. In some ways, although I've presented them as a group, they're not a group at all. There is more inequality within the 1% than there is in the other 99% of society. And the majority of the 1% are living down in London and the South East. For young members of the 1%, say a couple, he's getting £110,000, he's a GP, doing okay in London, and she's getting £100,000 as a lawyer in Canary Wharf, and they're in their late 20s, they're in the 1%, and they can't buy a three-bed house in zone 1, 2, or 3, and they can't, as we're sponsored by a mortgage investor, they don't qualify for a mortgage, because even though they're at the bottom of the 1%, and they don't feel well off. And if you ask them where they think they sit in society, they tell you they're somewhere in the middle. People really don't know what the distribution is. If we're going to go up, the median in the 1% is 300,000. You're doing okay then. You'll get a mortgage. You may even not need one because you'll have some wealth. Mortgages are for the little people now. Mortgages are for people who need to borrow, and mortgages are also now a privilege. Mortgages used to be open to a very large section of society that was growing and growing and growing. Now you have to be doing extremely well in the southeast of England to be allowed to borrow the money from a bank to be able to buy a house. Most purchasers of property in Oxford, where I now live, and in London, are landlords. They're buying up the houses, and the landlords who are buying up the houses, they're all members, these ones, of the 1%. Most landlords are not members of the 1%. Most landlords only own one or two properties, and they're amateur landlords. Don't really know what they're doing, and some of you may be among that group. But all those landlords who have at least half a dozen properties are in this group. So that's one part of them. But the largest part of all is finance and law. Only 3% of people in the 1% are celebrities or sports people. It's absolutely tiny, but they're the group you tend to know. And many of these lawyers and financiers are working for other people. They're employed and they don't have a huge amount of freedom over what they do. And their job is to make people above them better off. To get into the best 10 for the 1%, you need an annual income of about £1 million. And I can take you up and up, at which point you begin to get some more freedom. The best of 3 or 4 households in Britain have an annual income of about £100 million. You may think this is not possible or it's ridiculous, but you can verify it simply by taking the Sunday Times Rich List and looking at those families who increase their wealth by over £100 million in a year. They have an income of over £100 million. So there's this enormous difference within the 1%, from some of the richest people on the planet to most of the people within the best off 1% being tied to jobs, struggling to get a basic house, feeling obliged to use private education, because almost everybody within the 1% uses private education. Half of the top 10% do and 1% of the rest. And that costs them money. So they're not actually, you know, swirling around having a wonderful time. And it's often thought that they're simply off to the Bahamas, you know, it's great, life's easy for them. But that's not the way it is. And that's partly why they have such high salaries. Because they say they need this money. They have to have this income just to be able to buy a house, just to be able to give their children an education, as they put it. You know, and it's only fair. It's only fair because other people like them are getting that. And that's the trap we've got ourselves into. If you compare our 1% to the 1% in Switzerland, which is also a banking country, the Swiss 1% take half as much. I think their banks are probably better than our banks. So the argument that you have to pay this much to get talent simply doesn't wash. And also, I tried to hint in this book, I don't think they're a particularly happy group, even though they're taking a seventh of all income. I think the 1% would actually be better off, and the 1% appear to be better off in other countries where they have less, because most of their money is spent keeping up with the Joneses, it's keeping up with each other. So I'll cut to the chase and say what I think we need to do about it. It's not just me saying this. The person who said it for the longest and most obviously is Thomas Piketty. Thomas Piketty and his colleagues have this wonderful graph. If I was going to have one graph, I would bounce the graph for you instead, because it's one graph. The graph has time along the bottom, if you can imagine it, from 1960 through to now. And it has the change in the take of the 1% along the side, and it shows which countries have the 1% taken the biggest increase since the 60s, when all countries were pretty equitable in the rich world. And the countries where the take of the 1% has gone up the most are the United States and the United Kingdom. Can you guess which countries reduced marginal income tax rates the most? It's the United States and the United Kingdom. Our 1% take so much because we tax them so little. They repeatedly say they pay a third, 33% of all income tax, which they do because they pay themselves so very much and the rest of the population has so very little. Huge numbers of people cannot afford to pay any tax at the bottom of society. What high marginal rates of income tax do in countries like Germany, which have them, is not raise money. The reason to have a tax rate of 50% say, over €50,000 a year, which is the normal European marginal tax rate. People in Europe pay 50% tax once they earn €50,000. 60% at €100,000, 70% at €200,000. I would go for 80% at €500,000, and maybe even 90% at €1 million. It's not to raise money. You don't tax people at these rates because you want to bring in tax. You tax people at high marginal rates, as we did in the past, to help them not be greedy. To help them. I think if I can try and get one thing over, it's the reason we need higher rates of marginal tax on top incomes. There was a young banker recently, not that recent, I think it was about 3 years ago. I think he was working for Barclays, I probably got it wrong, but he was earning $4 million a year. And he found out that his contemporary doing exactly the same job, quite an important job in the bank, moving money around the world, desperately trying to make it increase in value, was earning $6 million a year. He was incensed. He was young, he was male, he was a banker, he probably had a high testosterone level, and this thing really mattered to him, but he was incensed. He felt his $4 million was really bad if somebody else is paying six. How do you help somebody like that not think that they really need to have an extra $2 million a year? You tax it at 90%. You know, and then do you really argue with your bosses that you want that extra $2 million when in fact 1.8 million of it's going to go straight to the exchequer? And would your bosses be willing to give you that tax rate when they know that they'll just be giving the government the money? So that's why countries have high marginal tax rates. And what happens when, say, Barclays doesn't spend £2 million on that young man? What can it do with that £2 million a year? Oh, we can employ some more cashiers who can be really helpful in those branches that used to exist, which they've cut because they're cutting people who are paid less. And we create more jobs. If we go back to when you were young, to the mid-1970s, if we were to take the top 1% and the top 10% and reduce their incomes back in real terms to what people got proportionately then, so they'd still be the best off in society, but they will not be so many times better off. The amount of money that you'd save by doing that for the 1% and the 10% is enough money to employ all the 1 million young people who are out of work full time on a living wage 15 times over. Right? 15 times over. It's a little back of the packet calculation. There was full employment back in the 50s, 60s and 70s because we shared out the money more. Our salary and wage bill has never been higher, and so we don't have enough money and enough jobs for everybody, and we have so much part-time employment and it's so poor. And all of this would make more sense to me if people really were living the life of variety at the top. But they're trying to buy that three-bed house in Fulham, you know, and worrying about the fact that they might be buying at the peak. Somebody's going to buy at the peak. Yeah. None of us know when the peak's going to come. And the people who are going to be really burnt at the peak are going to be people in the top 10% and the top 1%, because they're the only people who can actually buy in the housing market at the moment. You know, so it really isn't a life of Riley life at the top. So my solution to it is that we talk seriously about high marginal tax rates. We explain to the people who don't understand it's not about raising money. Although the 1% may pay a third of all our income tax, the 1% overall don't pay tax at a higher rate than the poor because of VAT and other taxes. So the 1% are not currently overtaxed. Anyway, and the last thing I'll say, is what is a fair rate of inequality? You know, what kind of inequalities, what is a justified rate, what kind of rate do you need? There are two ways of looking at this. One way is just to see what rates of equality other countries have managed to achieve and whether those countries are basket cases. So we can look at France, which is a much more equal country than us, and we can say it has higher marginal tax rates, and we can say, is the median family in France worse off? And people don't do this in Britain. And it's really easy to do. You take the income survey from France, you take the income survey from Britain, you line all the households up, and you take the middle house from both countries, the middle household, the middle family, and you can compare them. So you've already worked out that the French one is better off than the UK household, okay? By how many 1,000 euros do you think the median French household is better off? Any guesses? 1,000? 9, you're close. 10,000 euros more a year. That equates to about, you know, £4,000 for one job, you know, £5,000, a bit less for another job. The median French family, that country that we lambast for being in such a bad state, the median family is 10,000 euros better off a year in income, and that is before they pay their housing costs. And the housing costs are lower in France than they are in England. The way we talk about it is we talk about how French productivity is higher. We measure productivity through how much people are paid. But productivity is higher in more equal countries because people are treated in a better way, treated more seriously. People work better when they're respected better. So that's one way of looking at it, is to look at other countries and what they do. Japan, is my favourite country on this, of showing what you can achieve. There are fewer people paid over £1 million a year in Japan than there is in the Barclays Canary Wharf Tower in London. In that single skyscraper, there are more millionaires than in the whole of Japan. If you look at the income gaps between bosses and workers in Japan, they're not miles apart. And Japan has done extremely well since the crash in 2008. And despite the supposed two lost decades, the Japanese are the healthiest, longest-lived people on the planet. They did very well in education and so on. So that's one way of looking at what could be achieved. You could look at the Netherlands, you can say our 1% could take half as much. I think it's the most practical way. But the other way is to be slightly theoretical about it. So I'll end with this. I think you can justify an 8-to-1 income ratio. And this is how I do it. Somebody might work twice as long as somebody else. Most full-time jobs are 8 hours a day. But some can be 16. I don't know. The person running this festival, who I don't know, so let's not pick on him, but the person running this festival, I suspect, has to get up at 6 in the morning and start work at 7 and deal with whichever speaker has decided not to come today or whatever it is. I suspect they have to wine and dine some people in the evenings, and although it might sound fun the first time you wine and dine, by the 500th time you've done it, it's a 16-hour day. They should be paid twice as much if that's what they're actually doing. Some jobs are more onerous than other jobs, and I think you should pay people twice as much if they're doing a job that you don't really want to do. Fixing sewer pipes is my example, deep sea diving is another one. But the reason I cap it at 2 times is I don't think we should have any job that is so onerous that nobody wants to do it. It's that bad. The reason I cap the time at twice is that you can work 16 hours a day just and function. You really can't work more than 16 hours a day, it isn't physically possible. So, double because you're working really long hours, double because the job's onerous, and finally, some people can be twice as good as other people. And if you're twice as good, I think it's fair that you're paid twice as much. So, I'm not into performance pay, but this is a way of explaining it. You could get a school teacher or a doctor that is generally twice as good as another school teacher. But you shouldn't get any who is 3 or 4 times as good, because you should have nobody teaching who's so bad that they're 3 or 4 times worse than anybody else. Okay, so 2 times 2 times 2 times gives me my 8-to-1 ratio. I can justify to myself 8-to-1 differences. 8-to-1 inequalities happen to be what we have now in Oxford colleges that pay the living wage to their cleaners. And if an ancient, traditional, slightly elitist Oxford College can survive with an 8-to-1 pay ratio between the person at the top and the person at the bottom, I'm sure a bank will manage it. Maybe the people working in the banks are far, far cleverer than people in Oxford Colleges. Maybe that's why you need to pay them so much. But I think we need to talk about what's right, what's fair, what's reasonable, how we've become this extreme. And to leave you with a worry, if you look at the current trends, the trends for the last 5 years, 5 years ago, of the 25 richest countries on the planet, we were the 4th most unequal. The 3 above us were Portugal, Singapore, United States. Portugal, with the collapse, the rich have lost their money, it's now beneath us. Barack Obama's actually increased taxes and marginal taxes in the United States. By 2025, we will overtake the United States, and by 2030, we will overtake Singapore, and we are going to win the global race, and we're on track to become the most unequal country of the richest 25 countries in the world by 2030. This is Plan A. People who believe in inequality think it's a good thing. Nothing wrong in having lots of very highly paid people in your country. We are the poster child for inequality, and it will carry on until we get angry enough about it, because the last time it got better, the reason your childhood was so good in the 1970s is people got really, really angry in the 1920s and 30s about how much the rich had been taking and the state of the country then. Half our inequality from 1920 to 1970 went by 1939, before the Second World War. The Second World War set it in stone, but we had decade after decade after decade of rising equality. We could get decade after decade after decade of rising equality again, but you don't get it without the kind of anger that we saw before, and without helping to explain to people at the top that we want to tax them a lot, not to get money from them, but to help control them from their own greed. That's what needs to happen. There will always be greedy people. A disproportionate number of them will always be found among the 1%. They cannot control themselves by definition. They are greedy. The rest of society has to control them. And what we failed to do since the late 1970s, and like many other countries, is we failed to control our greedy. And we're suffering as a result of that. Thank you very much.
The burden of your book, the argument of your book, is that we can't afford the super rich anymore. They're taking too much out of the economy and slowing economic progress for the rest of us. The kind of solution you have in mind is a return to the values and the practices of the post-war period, between 1945 and, say, 1975. But most of us in this tent are old enough to remember the 1970s. They were terrible. They were just terrible. The system ground to a halt, and there was a popular revolt against the kind of solution that you are proposing. And that popular revolt manifested itself in large swathes of traditional Labour voters, especially in the South, switching to the Conservatives, and they never come back. And because they accepted the argument that inequality is the engine of wealth creation, and that having a few people at the top earning lots of money creates wealth for the rest of us, through the mechanism of investment and the growth of small businesses become medium-sized businesses and so on. That consensus is still pretty... The Conservatives have just won an election. That consensus is still in place, isn't it?
It's still really strong. Many rich countries in Europe were in a very similar situation in the 1970s. When the oil price went up, there was a recession everywhere. This happened all over. But the other European countries didn't do what we did. They didn't take us. So the question is, why did we act in that way when they also had mass strikes? They also ran out of the toilet bowl at various times. They also had mines who turned the electricity off. The big difference between us and the rest of mainland Europe is that one reason that things were getting tricky in the 70s, we've never acknowledged, is that we were the richest country on earth just a few decades earlier. Part of the reason that we were the richest country on earth was that we practically owned half the planet. We had colonies, we had India. We lost India. George Orwell made this point to the Labour government in 1945 and said you can afford a welfare state because you've got the colonies. We lost India, then we lost colony after colony in Africa. We told ourselves a myth that our imperialism was a white man's burden and it was a great tragedy to us that we had to go out and all the rest of the world, and we were doing it as, you know, some kind of great gift. We weren't benefiting it from it, but we were benefiting from it. All Chinese school children are told how we sent battleships to China to force them to buy our opium from India. We don't teach any of our children in our schools about this. So we had a bigger fall than France or Germany because we were going from so far high up. And it was hard a shock to take. The South East of England swung to the Conservatives in October 1974. If you compare the 70s, the February election of 74 and the October election, it's in October 74 when the South East goes stormy. The country as a whole didn't. The Labour government, the South East went. The year after Margaret Thatcher becomes leader, and that's Bill Howard. And the talk that
only very well off people will save you begins then to get stronger and stronger. Philanthropists in America, rich people in America, have just said, you know, if really rich people generate jobs, why are there not millions and millions of jobs? We have unemployment in the past and the 1% took far less. You'll find people in every other country of Europe will say that inequality is bad, the degree of inequality is bad, and the amount of money people get at the top is too much. The quote I use far too often is a Dutch boss of Royal Dutch Shell, saying if you paid him twice as much, you wouldn't work any harder, and if you paid him half as much, you'd work just as hard. Those kind of quotes you can find in every European country. You can even find them in the United States of America. People like Warren Buffett saying it's wrong because his secretary pays a higher tax rate than he does. We're unique. I have not found a single rich person in Britain who says there is any problem with the degree of inequality. We are an extremely strange country. And my excuse is that we are still in the shock of moving from being the richest country on the planet to becoming a normal European nation, and the shock so great that this little bit of nation got very close. What was it? 5.5% of people have voted the other way. Then certainly the collapse the next day, I think, because it wouldn't be that hard anymore. That close to thinking of breaking off to become a normal European nation and escape from a country trapped in the period of colonial power. And if you think about where the Conservatives come from, you know, everyone's family's money came from plantations. His father was a stock worker. You know, we're actually being governed by an elite who are very closely connected to that empire wealth. Look at Osborne's family money. At some point,
it's probably where it comes from industry, isn't it?
Isn't it making wallpaper for the very, very well off?
Yes.
So you require very well off people to buy wallpaper?
Well, okay, let me speak up. In the 1980s, the bulk of the growth in the economy during the Thatcher and Major years came from the growth of small and medium-sized enterprises. And Margaret Thatcher put in place conditions in which it would be easier for small businesses to become medium-sized businesses and so on, and take on more staff. Most of the jobs that were created in the 80s and the early part of the 1990s were in that sector. That was successful, wasn't it? That redressed the problem in our society.
You got to 3 million unemployed by 83. We then changed the definition of unemployment 30 times to try to get the number down. All these more equitable countries have small and medium-sized businesses as well. There's not something special about Britain that allows it to have small and medium-sized businesses. But the biggest change in the 80s was the big bang in 86. Finance went up to be 12% of our GDP, just 4% of our workforce, and 12% of our GDP before the crash. We didn't have a success story in the 80s and 90s for those people. Every year in the 80s and 90s, the gap between the top and the bottom got wider and wider. The living standards of the middle only goes ever so gradually. It wasn't bad in the States when it actually went down, ever so gradually. It wasn't a success story.
All right, let me say one last thing before I open it to the audience. I lived in France for a time, about 10 years ago, and there is a small business sector in France. Of course, you see it on every French high street. They haven't got the same homogenised retail sector that we've got. The small family retailer and restaurateur is still very strong. What they're all terrified of doing is turning those small businesses into medium-sized businesses. Because once you employ more than 10 people or more, you become liable as an employer for all sorts of obligations that you typically can't. They don't want to take the risk on, because if you have a market opportunity to be able to say employ 15 or 20 people this year, and that market disappears next year, you've still got to keep them on the payroll. And I'll give you one example. I interviewed an English guy who was a wine grower in France, and he employed 9 people. And he said I could increase my market, but I have to take on more people, but it's too risky. So I'm going to stay as a small business. I'm not going to, because I become responsible for their pensions. And I can't take the risk that the market I'm enjoying at the moment will still be there in 5 years' time. He had one employee who he wasn't able to sack, even though he was in prison. The guy was in prison for beating up his wife, and it was illegal for him to sack the man. So the state imposes a constraint in France on opportunities for economic growth.
It does, but the median French family is still 10,000 euros better off a year. So if you didn't know where you're going to be in society, you didn't know if you're going to be poor or you're going to be rich, but you have to choose now where you're going to be born, you'd be much more sensible to choose France, despite these problems in France. And if you compare it, what's wrong with having lots of small stores that employ less than 10 people? The alternative in Britain is a Tesco routine. For every one job that Tesco creates, 10 jobs are lost in inefficient local businesses. Now you may say Tesco is more efficient. Tesco was one of the major sponsors of the Conservative Party throughout this period. Was it named Shirley Porter as the daughter of the
man? Yeah. But I'm really conceited. You played the Tesco card. It seems to me now, for the first time since the 1980s, that the intellectual underpinnings of this idea that the rising tide lifts all boats, ultimately, are falling apart. That there is a new intellectual consensus is forming that says not only is inequality unfair, it's actually economically inefficient as well, and indeed dangerous, as you alluded to.
Right, in the southeast of England, the quarter of the electorate, only one quarter of the UK electorate, and a quarter of the UK electorate, the voting Conservative, still believe either the rising tide lifts all boats or the vote's going down and I don't want to be one of those votes.
And London, as you say, is one of the richest places, is the richest place in the country. It's also one of the poorest.
Oh, it's got the biggest concentration of poverty in Europe. It's now the most expensive city on the planet by a household. If you look at every other city that's had that label of becoming the most expensive city on the planet with 15% of your price rises, you can see what's going to happen. And when it happens, and it has to happen eventually, when the London bubble pops, the election has just given it a further boost, so we thought it couldn't go up any further. When the London property bubble pops, the effects across the whole UK economy on business and banking are going to be terrible. People will lose their jobs up here, because that house in Fulham, the three-bed house that costs £800,000, is suddenly only worth £200,000. Well, maybe. It's happened in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. In 1989, Tokyo was the most expensive place in the world. The Royal Palace in Tokyo, which is very large, it's 10 square miles a garden or something ridiculous, but the Royal Palace in Tokyo was worth more than the whole of California. That's the kind of thing. Kensington and Chelsea are now worth more than the whole of Denmark. GDP. When house prices collapse in Tokyo, they halve. They're still at that level. I mean, if you want one reason to worry about inequality more than anything else, it's the state of precariousness that puts your whole country in when you allow this to happen and you push all the money and so much wealth into the hands of such a tiny number of people.
Let's get the house lights up, could we please start and get loads of questions? Let's start with gentlemen here.
Thank you. You say one of the outcomes is that people will get really angry, but let's assume that they don't get angry enough or the elite successfully in ignoring the anger. I think what you've just said is that it's not sustainable anyway, that we're going to head for another crash, is that right?
Yeah, another crash is likely, and that will be fair.
Certain
within 15 years.
Right.
Within 15 years, all those undergraduates in Britain who have debts of at least £56,000 if they've got a poorly paid job, £150,000 will be paid back if they get a well paid job. They will enter the housing market. you can work out the end date for the crash, unless we're going to make all our university graduates be mentors for their whole life. I'm really going to go back to the time of our grandparents, when 90% of the population had remained from vandals, including the half the population in Ambridge University. It defies belief that this can continue for that length of time.
Yes, question up there.
I just wondered whether there's a dilemma, Danny, thanks very much for your talk, as to whether we can get intoxicated in the statistics, which you're obviously very able to lead us into. You use words like rights, fair, reasonable, without actually suggesting to us how we might try to define these. And one of the interesting things from the Scottish context, a little bit historically, is that at the turn of the century, people in Glasgow didn't think it was right, they didn't think it was fair, they didn't think it was reasonable for the rents to be raised, and the people went on the street. And from south of the border, they didn't trust people on the street, that it sent 10,000 of the army from England with tanks to actually quell it. So in a sense, that was an issue about rights, fairness, support, is reasonable. And it seems to me there's been landscapes of inequality which are much, much broader from the same historic period. For example, social care is a scandal in this country. Looked after children is a scandal in the country. And the statistics every day are highlighting these things, which we hear. Haven't got the language to talk about equity. How do we deal with equity is a problem. And the danger is that we demonise the people at the top. And we can't deal with the fact that they can't treat themselves with dignity by taking the money. But also, if we deal with equity, we've got to deal with our selfishness and greed. And I think it's a Pope calls it the globalisation of indifference, which intoxicates society. And Michael Marmot, an atheist, actually talks about we live in toxic systems. We store up these toxic systems.
Yeah.
So, okay, we only get some more people. We also had their hand up. So, yeah, gentlemen there, and then somebody
that. Yes, Simon from Oxford, if you would say something about the stratification of universities in this country. I talk about Russell Groups, differential salaries, tuition fees in England, all those kind of conditions that tell me why money goes, the most research money goes to the Golden Triangle, Oxford, Cambridge, and Imperial, and nothing else matters. What are you going to do about that?
The whole chapter in your book on education.
There's quite a lot. I wrote an earlier book called Injustice, to take the decisions that come out. I wrote that one in Sheffield, when I had no idea I'd be moving to Oxford. And because I grew up in Oxford, I literally picked on Oxford University and went through everything that I thought was wrong with it in that book. And he still gave me a bit, but maybe that's why they gave me a job. On the first question, this is why I was trying to talk about what would really a fair difference be. I a few years ago tried to suggest that Labour should have a different kind of a pledge card, not a party member, but you only have five pledges. And I said you should have five really simple and basic ones, which are everybody will have a home regardless of what happens, every child will have a school place, nobody will go hungry and have to go begging for food for a food kitchen. So it sounds like a pretty bottom station there, but if you can at least, and the tragedy was, just before the last election in England, John Curtis and Labour could not commit themselves to promising that within 5 years of a Labour government there would be no need for anybody to go to a food bank. You ought to be able to promise that. University sector. I mean, it's interesting that Scotland has it inside Scotland itself, with universities. I suspect as we get poorer, we're not going to be able to afford this kind of research funding in general in 5 or 10 years' time as much. The powerful universities will argue for it, will desperately try to keep the science budget there. But if you imagine one of the numerous scenarios that happened, Andrew Howdy, the Deputy Director or whatever the Bank of England, is going out the world saying another banking crash is likely. In the aftermath of that, what's going to happen? Scotland, I think the Scottish budget is 36 billion, but everything, 1 billion goes to the universities in Scotland. When that budget gets contracted, not just because the English are being nasty, but because the country as a whole has a bit less money, out of that 36 billion budget for Scotland, do you still really want to give a billion to the universities so that they can do their well-being research? Or do you just like them to be good, decent universities, as most universities in France and Germany are? If you look at the websites of our universities, the front page of the websites of our universities, 30 of them claim to be in the top 10. and the websites are garish, self-promoting, elitist. If you look at the front page of a website of a normal European university, it's a bit like Glasgow. Hamburg is the university for people around Hamburg. Our university's problem is that they've moved away from being places that serve local and regional populations to increasingly trying to attract the global elite of children, international students. Plan A, or part of the reason why we could get this rising inequality that you talked about, is that trickle down can work in one country. One country in the world could be the country in which more billionaires choose to have a home than any other. You have to have a flat in London if you're a billionaire. All the other cities are optional. In which children of the rich descent to go to university and to school, we'll be the Swiss Trinity School for the very rich, and our children can be butlers and cleaners and nannies and servants for the very wealthy. And that is, if you like, Boris Johnson's plan for London. And this is why we need to be careful, because Britain could do this, and the nearest equivalent is Singapore. But since the crash in 2008, Singapore brought in 8 laws to stop capital flight in Singapore, to stop foreigners being allowed to buy property in Singapore, because they could see what would happen in Singapore if that happened. And so the money from China flew over Singapore and set it up in London.
Denmark has a similar policy, I think, a similar law in its statute of stopping people from outside buying up holiday homes.
Yeah, and Switzerland has it, for large parts of Switzerland.
Yes, we've got a question back.
Thank you. Thank you, yes. Why does the Conservative Party continually blame the poor for being poor and the unemployed for being unemployed and the homeless for being homeless? And is the answer either Corbyn, Burnham or Sturgeon?
There's a lovely book written about America called Why America Hates the Poor. And in the US early on, Ronald Reagan talked about black welfare queens and began a rhetoric in the States about people at the bottom. I don't know what was going on in Reagan's head and his advisors' heads, but the population of the States was taught to begin to really hate the poor. And we copied that teaching a bit later, the sherpism, the snipers and so on. And newspaper tabloid stories about particular families demonising. If you look at Conservatives, if you look at Ian Duncan's face when he's talking about poor people, you can actually see a look of disgust appear over it. So I'm not a psychologist, but it needs looking into and sorting out.
So is the answer Jeremy Corbyn or Nicola Sturgeon?
Oh, for you lot. Yeah, that's your choice. Well, I don't get that choice.
You lot.
You lot. Well, I'm not on what portion you are. Hey, who's from England? Just out of interest. Okay, tell me what you want. I think what's going on in the Labour Party is really interesting and very good, and it's copying Scotland, and maybe wouldn't have happened if the independence campaign hadn't happened. It's moving the entire party in a direction that is useful. It partly helps slightly to drag the Conservative Party in that £1.09 an hour living wage. I know it's a lie, I know they think that it's a bit soft. But, you know, even the Tories have done something in that direction. The movements of the parties is the important thing. From the 70s onwards, all the parties moved rightwards. So by the last election, the Labour Party, even the Red Miliband, was to survive the Margaret Thatcher had been in 1979. You need all the parties to move the other way, you need the Labour Party to move the other way. I've never thought that individual leaders were that important in this country. I think whoever wins it, because of what has happened, even Jeremy, if he wins it, things are going to move and work. Well, I don't have a vote, I haven't even paid for £3 vote. I obviously have a lot of sympathy for Jeremy Corbyn's position. I have no fear about what happens if he wins. But if I'm an optimist, I think even if Liz was to win it, things would still get better and could. Because she would have to move her policies and her beliefs to say, and what also happens is people's beliefs change, and everybody around them begins to believe different things. They change. So part of the reason why Tony Blair could be Tony Blair is the group of people around Tony Blair, the ones who smiled at him every day, believed what they taught him to believe, and he believed it back. Yeah. It wasn't Tony Blair's fault. Tony got Blair, born at a different time, could have been a magnificent 1960s Labour leader. It was everybody around him, that's the problem. The individuals are all that important.
They bought into the idea that a rising tide lifts all boats. So some people at the top are super wealthy, the wealth will trickle down and benefit all of us. New Labour was founded on that principle.
New Labour, but it was a small kind of militant tendency infiltration in Labour. So Peter Mandelson, I don't care how much the rich own as long as they pay their taxes, and he, you know, his tax affairs are still, he owes some tax. He's paid his own company, and it hasn't paid tax yet. New Labour was part of that shift to the right that occurred across Britain at the time. There was a similar shift to the left that occurred earlier, so the Macmillan government built more council houses than the Labour government done before it. Really winning is not a one political party or another winning an election, it's changing the underlying mood that matters. And when you change the underlying mood and you get things like PR and choosing more choice, it doesn't actually matter so much who wins.
We've got such a lot to get through, only a few minutes left. I'm going to take a question from a lady there, and then there's a man on the very end of that row. We'll take two at once. Yes.
How do you change the valuing of the roles that people do in society, given that it is the financiers who are earning so much? I work in mental health advocacy. I earn less than the national average wage, and yet I was required to have a master's degree in order to get that job.
How do you police that? How do you make this happen? And a gentleman over there, yes.
How do you change?
I mean, I would argue that the Blair and Brown governments were a tremendous boon to the British people, and actually in terms of supporting public services, whether it's health or education or Sure Start or working family tax credits, they did much to reduce inequality in Britain. And I think simply to label Tony Blair as a right winger is a misconstruction. But what I'd invite you to consider is whether we ought to move on to a stakeholder capitalism of the kind that Will Hutton has promoted in the past, whereby employees of businesses have much greater rights. And we're not simply looking at the wealth creation for shareholders and those who manage financial businesses at the top.
Yes, the last Labour government did do a number of things that were good. In fact, your major did a number of things that were good. And they got teachers' wages up, which was great, but they got head teachers' wages up even more, so they increased the gap. They got more funding in the health service, but doctors got the bigger pay rise than nurses. So before the 2010 election, Nick Clegg used to hit Labour with inequality has gone up under your period, which the measure was that it did. It had by accident. We Labour didn't want inequality to rise, they didn't realise what it would have to do to have to turn it around. On your question about what we need to do, it's public conversations and simply saying it isn't good, and it's already started. In 2005, you could see bankers buying bottles of champagne for £30,000 in London and partying. You no longer see those pictures anymore. Little parties happen, yeah, but it's much more quelled. If you look at the BBC, you look at the Director General of the BBC, you watch the salary of the Director General going down towards the regional level. Even if you look at the banks, we have no more Bob Diamond. Bob was sent back to New York, and nobody is paid as much as him anymore. There is an increased and intense sensitivity at the top. They partly think we're misguided, we don't understand how wonderful they are. But they do now at least know, apart from the boss of WPP, afterwards, they do know not to say, look, I'm getting all these millions because I'm so brilliant. And it's the beginning of that changing moral sentiment that happened before. History doesn't repeat. But if we don't say there is nothing impressive about you taking so much money, we're not going to help. I was once asked by a group of board level bankers to do a talk to them about inequality. And I was sitting up, I think it was in the Durkee in London, and I had to eat food while talking. I asked them towards the end of this, I said, why don't you ask me to talk about inequality? And one of them said, because my son joined People and Planet before Christmas, and he stopped talking to me because he thinks I'm part of the problem. I don't know, a secret campaign to recruit the children and top financiers might help. But every day, quiet personal conversations, saying something when you wouldn't have liked say it because you think it's right, that's the kind of change that happened before. It happened in the middle of two wars, it was a different time, but it needs people to say that isn't right. you need to look at the top salaries in China. You need to say, do three of the four top university vice chancellors in this country need a chauffeur? Or not need a chauffeur in Scotland anymore? It's personal, it's embarrassing. But that's the kind of things that when you begin to say it, it begins to hit people. And bring the top salaries to the top perks down. As long as the person at the top is paid less, everybody else near the top of the organisation ends up being paid less. You'd be amazed how much money is saved. And all that happens is that property prices in Newtown fall slightly. And everybody can still get a house. And you can employ the youngsters. And you can pay people who are working in mental health a decent wage because you've got the cash to actually do it. But it has to happen across the board. You can't have pair shirts. You can't have one person making a sacrifice. If that one person makes a sacrifice, and they can no longer live in a house because the health is still possible. That's why you need government action. That's why you need higher rates of marginal taxation.
Before we end, can I just say, can you let Danny leave the tent first so I can get into the book signing tent next door? It's a tremendously good read, I do recommend it. If you've enjoyed the session, please join us in the book signing tent. Thanks again to Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust for your sponsorship of this event. That wouldn't happen without rich people, by the way. please give a very warm thanks to...